How can knowing your numbers transform your business and personal finances? I chat with Mahmood Reza all about it in this episode of Architecture Business Club, the weekly podcast for solo and small firm architecture practice owners just like you who want to build a profitable, future-proof architecture business that fits around their life. I'm the host, John Clayton, and if you want a business in architecture that gives you more freedom, flexibility and fulfillment, then go to architecturebusinessclub.com/blueprint and download the Architecture Business Blueprint. It's the step-by-step formula to freedom for architects, architectural technologists and architectural designers, and it's absolutely free as a gift from me. Now let's discuss money matters and getting to know your numbers. Mahmood Reza is a business finance fixer, tax advisor, and author of I Hate Numbers. He has helped thousands of sole traders, business owners, artists, creatives, and social enterprises have businesses, not hobbies, make money, save tax, improve their money mindsets, and reduce their financial stress and anxiety. Mahmood believes that once you understand what your numbers are, where they come from, what they mean, you can use them to make better decisions and ultimately make or keep more money. You can learn more and connect with Mahmood at ihatenumbers.co.uk. Mahmood, welcome to Architecture Business Club.
Thank you very much, John. That was a beautiful introduction. It made me go slightly misty eye, but yeah, thank you for that. Thank you for inviting me.
Don't start crying. That wasn't, you know.
I'll do my best, Archie. I've got my Oscar speech ready just in case.
We'll save that for later if we've got time. Mahmood, I know outside of the work that you do, you're a bit of an adrenaline junkie on the quiet, aren't you? If you'd like to do a bit of scuba diving, you've done some of that in your time, haven't you?
I have done. I've done some of that. I've done some abseiling. I've done some various other activities. I know you probably think I'm very calm, accountant, financy person once you're doing things like that. But yeah.
It's not, as you say, it's not what you expect the kind of typical accountant to do in the free time. So I love it. I love all that sort of stuff as well. Not that I get much chance to do it these days, but yeah, scuba diving and bungee jumping, awesome fun. But we're not going to talk about that today. What we're actually here to talk about together is, well, it's the start of the new tax year when this episode is being published. So yeah, we're going to talk about money and the importance of getting to grips with our numbers. So why is it important that we get to grip with our numbers?
That's a great question. I think fundamentally, John, if we look at any business that goes in there, whether it's a private business, a not-for-profit, a social enterprise, a charity, ultimately, in order to deliver your why, as Simon, our friend Simon would say, if you don't have funds, maintaining your costs, providing a living for the people who work with you, provide a living for yourself, then ultimately your ability to serve and deliver impact is going to diminish and wave. And therefore, money is an important consideration. It's not the only one, but it's absolutely critical. It's like the fuel that goes into your car. If you don't have the fuel, you can't drive your car.
I totally agree with this. I've, I guess, sort of learned this the hard way, that I've never been motivated by money, but it's come to kind of bite me on the bottom over the years by not getting to grips with it. So I'm fascinated about this topic and what we're discussing today. So I think it's going to be really helpful, which I guess that sort of leads us on to thinking about money mindset. So, you know, how the way that you think about money, I've just mentioned I've never really been motivated by money. So how can your mindset that you have about money, how can that affect your finances in your business?
Well, that's a great question, John. I think if I look at, for example, focusing in that world of business, that sort of big overarching business that Carrick has a lot of players in there, is your behavior and your attitude mixed with your skills and abilities is a thing that combines to give you that ability to do whatever you're doing. And for me, you know, but whether it's a family issue, background, cultural, whether you've never worked before, whether you come from money, whether you've not come from money, I myself come from a family of nine, got a great deal of money on the table and all the rest of it, that influences how you interact with people, that influences invoicing clients, that invoices that money being a consideration there as well. And I think if you don't win that battle that goes on between your ears in business, then I think you find it very, very difficult to maintain a business. I would imagine it's the same, you know, in your world, John, that you can have brilliant skills and really be academically minded, But if you don't have the right stuff in terms of how you interact with people, how you interact with clients, your right attitude there, basically you're going to be a useless individual in that post.
Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. I totally agree with that. So it's interesting actually that you mentioned about how things like your background, your upbringing, those things can influence how we think about money.
Oh, yeah, very much so. And I think also, without wishing to be a marriage guidance counsellor, it also happens in when you've got businesses where you've got husband and wife working together, friends working together and all the rest of it. People in the UK, I think, still, generally speaking, have a very focused and myopic view about how they should discuss money, talk about it. For some people, it's a very grubby word. Some people react against their past, so where they may have come from a very impoverished background or money wasn't a particularly something that was plentiful, that influences how they react in terms of conserving money, not necessarily investing it in their business, being very cautious in terms of how they invest their time and money and energy. Some people go the other way around and they say, look, I had a very, you know, my background was such that I'm actually just going to be reckless. Some people have left a job that's very well paid. They go into the world of business and expect that same replica. And because they don't really discuss it and they don't really talk about it with their colleagues, people in their business and all the rest of it, it becomes a thing they have to figure out in their own heads, which is not really probably the best conversation space to have.
Yeah, I think it can be something that's quite a taboo subject for a lot of people, and it really shouldn't be, but it is. It's something that I in particular noticed in the world of architecture, particularly when it comes to how transparent practices are about what they charge and why they charge what they charge. And it can be very difficult to find out, you know, particularly thinking about this from a consumer's point of view. If you're looking to find an architect or an architectural practice to work with, like it's a real cloak and dagger when it comes to the numbers. So it's not just within the business themselves. It's also how they talk about numbers with their clients. You know, it's a real mystery.
I agree. And I don't know, John, if you find it in your own space that actually can sometimes raise a barrier. It can be an inhibitor to actually clients interacting with you. Because I think my own personal perception, if I think architects, okay, I also actually think it's going to be an extremely expensive investment. I think it's not, you know, I won't necessarily have the funds, even though I don't actually know what the value and the cost of an architect's service is and what they do. And if you're not really comfortable talking about money, I think with people, especially in a business context, it's going to be difficult. My personal view is when I interact with a new person, client, and all the rest of it, certainly don't be driven by money in its own right. But I think if you're not comfortable having a conversation about money with prospective clients, with your fellow partners, with investors, at the outset, that doesn't bode very well when you do start generating value.
Absolutely, yeah. It's going to be difficult to run your business if you're not willing to talk about it. Yeah. So, Mahmood, you came up with a concept related to money and finances. Planet, do it, profit. Can you tell me about that and just explain what that's all about?
Absolutely. So I think there's two or three things that come to play here. I've always been a big believer in what I call planning, not a plan, not a document, not a straitjacket that says, this is what I said I was going to do, therefore that's it. I mustn't do anything outside of that and it's going to be a fixed rigid. Because I think the whole idea about a plan, as soon as you say, this is my plan of action for the next 6 months, 12 months, it's out of date the moment you've signed it off in your own mind. So for me, unless you have some perception of what's going on through the windscreen of your business going forward, okay, it's very difficult to know what you've got to do in order to get to that end goal. So for me, it's always been, what is your end objective, your end destination? And what is the route? What is the thing you're actually going to be doing to get to that route? And I'll have to give some credit also to a lady called Jo Watson, who edited my book for me, my copy editor. And in a conversation with her, we came up with that phrase, planet, do it, profit. And for me, it encapsulates exactly what a business has got to do in order to actually get to that, you know, that end destination, that your nirvana, if you want, for want of a better term.
Got it. So the planet bit is the, obviously, the planning stage, kind of having some foresight into where you're heading and what the destination is.
Correct.
The do it bit. Is presume that's the implementation of the plan?
I mean, what I'd probably add to that, John, is the planet for me, as you're right, is about destination first, story. What's the story that you present to yourself, the activity? think about things like some people might, for example, be very, very cautious about, say, I want to get to this stage. And some people might be completely reckless that says, for example, you know, I only wish to, make £1 million, for example. Well, if you're starting from a base of zero and you're thinking to yourself, it'd be similar to somebody says, you know, I want to appear at the Albert Hall and perform a concert. Now, if you're like me, you probably wouldn't be let loose because my voice would probably drive dogs insane. However, if I'm actually a professional songster or I've actually got some experience there, the aspiration of the Albert Hall may not be that unrealistic. So it's about end objective, what's your goals, what's your ambitions, what's your mindset saying, and what is your behaviour saying there as well. The do it is the actual implementation, and it's about the mini milestones that you set yourself as you go along that journey. And if we think about anybody who's at the top of their relative game, singer, performer, and all the rest of there, they think to themselves, what do I need to do to actually be able to get to that where I've actually set myself out to be? So the doing it is a combination of that, how we avoid procrastination, how we avoid things like imposter syndrome, how we actually become more confident in ourselves, the actual investing the money, investing the time, the energy, and the profit is the end objective. You know, whatever that figure or that, you know, your nirvana looks like to you, is the result of all those. And it's not necessarily a linear, you know, but that, for me, those are three key segments.
Could we talk a little bit more about profit?
Absolutely.
Are there any guidelines or yardsticks that small business owners can use when it comes to profit? Because this is a question that has come up within some of the communities that I'm in with people in architecture. What is reasonable to expect or to aim for, maybe as a percentage of turnover? Have you got any thoughts on that from your experience working with other companies?
Yeah, I have. And I would say it's a classic finance person's response, by the way, John, to say it depends. But so here's what I would say. Depending, I think you as a business owner, whether you're an individual, whether you're a part of the partnership or you're a big conglomerate here, you've got to first of all decide, okay, on that bit that I get to at the end, you know, in terms of where I want to achieve there as well, I need to make sure that I've got enough funds to take me through to cover my costs, give myself a half decent living. And that level of profit, I would say as a startup, I would aim for to a break-even situation probably within a couple of years. If you do it much quicker than that, that's fantastic. But typically, a break-even situation for year one and year two, where you've actually managed to reward yourself to some extent, I think it's a great achievement. Real value and profit actually comes for most businesses after about 5 years, by the way. And beyond the 5 years, because you sustain, people know who you are, they've engaged with you and all the rest of it, then that's where you're going to make some excessive profits there. If you're talking about what should that figure be, it varies so much from sector to sector. So if you're a sole trader, sole proprietor in your world, it may be that your target profit is such that you can retain maybe a couple of months, 3 months worth of ongoing costs, and you manage to give yourself a salary or a reward that's commensurate with a more than a living wage, as far as that's concerned. If you've got obviously extra financial pressures because of home, that might be a different landscape. If you're working in the retail sector, you know by benchmarking other companies what that can be. So really, for me, I know it's a bit of a long answer, shaggy dog type story here. It's very much depends on the nature of the business you are and whereabouts you are in your business cycle.
Got it. Yeah, that makes sense. So for thinking of the listeners of the show who are going to be working in architecture, small business owners, many of them are going to be the sole practitioners, so sole traders, or maybe it's a small business with, you know, two or three staff, something like that. Yeah, so for those people, do you have any further thoughts on any sort of typical margins for those people in the audience? Remember, don't forget to download the Architecture Business Blueprint, the step-by-step formula to freedom for architects, architectural technologists, and architectural designers. You can grab the blueprint without any charge at architecturebusinessclub.com/blueprint. And if you're enjoying this episode, then please leave a 5-star review or rating wherever you listen to podcasts. Now back to the show.
That's an interesting point. And I would probably say where I would start from, if you want to get some sort of detailed number. If you look at that typical practitioner that's got 2 or 3 members of staff, I would probably say, in terms of service margin, I would probably be looking for about what they call a net margin. So after you've paid all your own costs, reward yourself, if you could aim for about 10-15%, that would be a good benchmark figure to begin with. That gives you enough funds to leave in the business, gives you enough reward on top of that. Obviously, you know, I'd imagine all practices, John, are going to differ, are they, in terms of the client base they deal with? So our mainstream practice might be different for somebody working from home. Somebody who's working with a certain target set in terms of wealth they've got might be earning a slightly different figure. As long as you've got enough to cover your costs, pay yourself what you think is a decent level of salary, okay, and have, you know, 3 months worth of overheads costs left over, and your lifestyle is as you want it to be, that to me is probably a good measure of, you know, a first initial target to go for.
I think that's a good idea, because I think sometimes we can get a little bit hung up on like what other people are doing and how other businesses are operating. And the truth is that particularly if you're a business of one, like the way that you set things up in terms of your numbers and your targets is very much related to you and the lifestyle that you've set out that you want to achieve, and it's not necessarily going to be aligned with what the practice down the road is doing in terms of their numbers. So I guess it's sort of taking it an individual approach to it. Yeah, that's really helpful. Thanks for that, Mahmood.
I mean, as you were saying that, John, I think there's one more thing I would factor in. If I go right back to the start, you know, for example, I would imagine for yourself, you could have, if you wanted to, you know, if you like it, it's actually said, you know what, I'm going to work for another practice. I'm not going to bother with this high-risk rollercoaster world of self-employment working for myself. And if people make that decision to work for themselves by accident or design, what you're going to factor is there's elements they say that they want from that self-employed life. So freedom, control, the flexibility, the ability to say to somebody, I don't actually like you, I don't want to work with you. Or actually, I'm going to go down this path, take weeks off the scuba diving. So you've got to factor that in, I think, as a social return on top of the financial return that you're making.
That's an interesting point, because the truth is that in my experience, that most of us, when we start our own business or become an entrepreneur or sole trader, it's not necessarily all about the money. It often isn't anything to do with the money. You know, obviously we need the money to get by, but the reasons for leaving a potentially secure job at another architecture practice and going out on your own is usually because you want more freedom, flexibility, and fulfillment in what you do, and not necessarily about wanting more money. But then it comes back to something we mentioned earlier about, having said all that, that if we neglect to get to grips with those numbers, even if we're not motivated by it, it can cause problems down the line. So I think that's the kind of caveat that I would say on this, that, you know, even if you're not motivated by making loads of money, that this is so important that we do get to grips with our numbers. Absolutely critical.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. Now, here's another spin on that. All I would say, if I was starting over again, I've been doing this for over 29 years now, is to say, your first target has got to be to say, what is it you need in your household, okay, to actually keep your head above water, to actually not starting to get stressed out because you haven't got enough money to pay bills. That's your first level of target. And if you can generate enough profit that goes to ideally cover that, so you can actually keep your head self afloat, maybe a little bit on top of that, that is your first profit target. Then you can move up, because you take the pressure off, you take the stress off thinking, when we're going to get the money from this month to go towards the mortgage, the bills, kids, and all the rest of it. Once you've moved past that, you then find that actually you're just topping up the tank. And that means instead of taking a couple of weeks off in a year, you could take 3 or 4 weeks off in a year. So I would say, if you want a profit margin test, it should be such that actually you're not having undue financial pressures at home and in your personal life.
Got it. Sage advice. Let's talk about record keeping. I mean, what is that, and why is it important keeping those records?
Okay. I like that question. I think that it serves two purposes. The normal one, you know, like when people get, you know, tax returns, compliance, keeping the regulators happy, like HMRC, companies out, charity commission if it's relevant, that's fine. You've got to do that. If you don't, you could, at worst case scenario, be eating prison food and keeping company with people you don't necessarily want to. That's a really extreme situation. So it's not the compliance side. It's not about doing the things. It's also, by the way, a criminal offence if you don't maintain records. But it's what's happening in between. So if you imagine at the end of a year, somebody says, right, here's my books. I either do them myself, send them to my accountant to get all those tax returns done. But if you don't have that information that runs throughout the year to say, what are things costing me? How much profit am I making, or how much money am I losing? Which clients give me best value, which clients are losing me money, and all that. If you can't get access to that, then you're going to find life really difficult here. And that's where the records come. It says, keep a track of what you're spending, who your customers are, chase you up money, and people who owe you money. Nowadays, I mean, we can talk about formats later on, but that's what I mean by record keeping, because your brain is a useless filing cabinet.
So what we're trying to avoid is not turning up at the accountant's doorstep at the end of the year with a big carrier bag full of receipts and disorganized mess saying, there you go, you sort the accounts out. So ideally, essentially, this is like bookkeeping, isn't it? We're keeping track of the ins and outs of the money going in and out of our business on a, you know, a weekly basis.
100%. Now, what I'd probably say, at the risk of probably getting shouted out if people are listening who are finance people, actually keeping the record just to keep the accountants happy, it should not be your primary aim. That's a consequence of keeping good records. It's about, I mean, look, John, typically we've known each other for a while. I know in your practice, as you're evolving and you're pivoting and doing different things, you'll want information to help you inform the decision. And if you don't have that financial information that goes with other information here, your decision-making is going to be quite narrow and quite lopsided. So for me, it's about knowing what goes on. So if you want something you want to record keeping, I would say as a bare minimum, even if you know what your bank account is looking like, who your customers are that owe you money, having that access in relative terms at your fingertips is such a, what I call an eye-opener, and it's so illuminating, it's so powerful.
One of the best investments that I've made over the years is in a cloud-based bookkeeping software. The particular one that I use is called Free Agent. There's all sorts out there. Xero, that's another popular one. QuickBooks. So we could go on and on. But essentially that has made it so much easier for me to just keep tabs on the finances and use it for invoicing, for consolidating, explaining transactions in and out of bank accounts. My accountant has access to the software. So when it comes time to sort out the company accounts, it just makes everything so much simpler. And I'm so glad that I took the advice of the advisor. It was a business advisor at my local bank that had said when I was setting up, I really strongly recommend that you pay this subscription and get this software and start doing this from the very beginning. And I'm so glad that I did. It's one of the few things that I did right from the very beginning.
You've done lots of things right, John. But listen, you know, that advice is exactly as I would say, as well as spot on, is don't look at something as a cost. You know, it's a lot of a mindset issue. Look at it as a good investment. About the amount of time and the access to knowing what's going on, it just gives people peace of mind. And I think if you're going to do nothing else, invest in accounting software. It's not that expensive these days either, but it's a worthwhile and you'll get your return back quite easily.
Absolutely. And actually, there's some of the banks now that offer it for free. They will offer a package for free. So it's worth checking out what offers are available from the banks. What about tax, Mahmood? Could we touch upon that briefly?
Yeah, we can actually. I'll say there's two things. There's the actual what taxes impacts on an individual. And I think there's also what I call the psychological thought process behind tax as well. So typically, most businesses, tax will affect them in probably one of three key areas. And the fact that as an individual, you might have to pay tax because of your business, to me, is actually a good sign. It means you're earning enough money, that might not feel like it, that the tax man wants a slice off you. Number two, in theory, the simple tax like VAT, again, most businesses at the startup phase, unless they choose to voluntarily register for VAT, VAT won't affect them. They'll pay it to their suppliers, and all you are is a tax collector. As far as HMRC is concerned, when you get to a certain level and you've got to do what they call register the VAT, you'll basically be a tax collector. Unpaid, no holiday, no benefits. You'll be working on behalf of the government, collecting it and paying it over to them. So the other main areas are is where an individual has to pay tax and where their organization or their company has to pay tax, but you cannot get away from it. From the moment we're born to the moment we die, everybody at some point will be paying tax.
Death and taxes, the only two certainties in life. That's what they say.
Absolutely. And it's the things that freak us out the most as well. Even though we know they're there, they're probably the ones that cause us a lot of stress.
Yeah. Something else that I did when I started out was the software I used gave me an approximate estimate of what my tax liability was likely to be. And I had a savings account that I used to set aside some money, you know, as the money came in, I thought, oh, okay, that tax liability number's going up. And it wasn't perfect at the end of the year, but it was not far off. And it was just an easy way of making sure that the money was there when it was time to come and pay the tax bill.
That's a good discipline. Great discipline. I mean, that approach, okay, if you do it either through software, what we'd normally advise clients to say, look, if you invoice a client for 100 quid, for argument, X percentage of that, so much in the pound, just take it out of the system, put it away in a deposit account. You earn a bit of interest on there, so you might even get a drink out of the tax people at the end of the year. But when you're looking at your bank statement, you know that more likely belongs to you, not to somebody else. And I think it doesn't present false optimism in terms of put that money aside, it's all saved up, and therefore when it comes that time to pay the bill, you've already got the money there, you know, bingo. Because when you work for somebody, you're having that money taken off you each week, each month. When you're working for yourself, you are your tax collector.
Yeah, it does require a little bit of discipline. Mahmood, that's been absolutely fantastic, really informative. So thanks for joining us today. But what would be the main thing you want people to take away from this conversation?
Okay, I would say probably three things, if I'm allowed three things.
Yeah.
Obviously, more strapline planning to a profit, but actually have an idea of what for you, not anybody else, what for you represents your endpoint, your destination within 12 months, 2 years, 3 years' time. And then figure out the journey you've got to make. What does it mean in activity? And then translate it into a financial plan. Number two, don't be scared, okay, that you don't know things, okay? You know more about finance than you give yourself the credit for. So don't be hijacked by language. And number three, enjoy it. Money will come if you do things well, but don't set unrealistic expectations for yourself there as well. And I just think you've got to be comfortable and confident in what you do. I have lost count of amount of mess ups I've made in my business life from the very beginning. Even, you know, in the last few years, I've made decisions that have cost me lots of money. I've worked with people that have cost me lots of money. So you've got to have a real strength, of, sense of resilience and strength, and just enjoy the ride.
That's great advice. Thanks, Mahmood. Was there anything else you wanted to add that we haven't already covered?
No, folks, that's very kind of you to give the website address. Obviously, I will plug my book, I Hate Numbers, which is not written for accountants, by the way, you'll be pleased to know. Obviously, I want to appear on that Richard and Judy show one morning to say, tell us about your bestseller book. But no, if anyone wants to check out, we've got loads of resources. We've got a YouTube channel, I Hate Numbers, and a podcast and a weekly vlog. They're all there. They're all accessible. But if you don't know, speak to your advisor, speak to your accountant. As I said, I think that's all. And thank you very much again, John, for inviting me onto your show.
You're very welcome. I'll make sure those links go in the show notes so people can access those resources. Mahmood, I've got one very quick final question. It's nothing to do with numbers. I love to travel and discover new places, and I think architecture is about place. So could you tell me one of your favourite places and what you love about it? It could be near or far.
Okay, let's say Barbados, actually, but not actually for the beaches. In the north of the island of Barbados, Barbados is a lovely island. I've been there quite a number of times with my wife. There's a north part of the island called Bathsheba, and it faces on, my geography is terrible, I think it's the Atlantic it faces onto, but it's very rough, very ready, but very fascinating. You know, sometimes when you look at fires, for example, they can entrance you and you just look at them. You've got the ocean crashing against the rocks and all the rest of it. So it's got an element of stillness and beauty. And you just look at it and you think, do you know what? You're just a mere pimple on the backside when you look at Mother Nature and its rawest. So in the context of a beautiful island, that's a part of the world that I find particularly tranquil and particularly fascinating as well.
Oh, it's an awesome place. I was fortunate enough to visit many years ago just for a short holiday with my wife, and we absolutely loved it. And if you go back, Mahmood, Carlisle Bay, I recall, was a great spot for scuba diving. They had about five different wrecks that was just not far off the beach. So put that on your to-do list next time you go.
I will do. John, listen, thanks again.
All right. Thanks, Mahmood.
Take care. Bye.
Next time, I chat with architect Sara Collata about how you can craft a location-independent architecture business. Thanks so much for listening to this episode of Architecture Business Club. If you liked this episode, think other people might enjoy it, or just want to show your support for the show, then please leave a glowing 5-star review or rating wherever you listen to podcasts. It would mean so much to me and makes it easier for new listeners to discover the show. And if you haven't already done so, don't forget to hit the subscribe button so you never miss another episode. If you want to connect with me, you can do that on most social media platforms. Just search for @MrJohnClayton. The best place to connect with me online, though, is on LinkedIn. You can find a link to my profile in the show notes. Remember, running your architecture business doesn't have to be hard, and you don't need to do it alone. This is Architecture Business Club.